Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, a weekly public affairs series featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute which encourages excellence in scholarship and seeks to affirm the importance of the humanities in American life.
It was Martin Buber who said, "He who knows one religion knows none." I would apply Buber's axiom to the study of fundamentalisms. He who knows one fundamentalism knows none.
Fundamentalism and the Modern World, this week on Soundings. My guest is Bruce Lawrence, an historian of religion who teaches at Duke University. Bruce Lawrence is the author of Defenders of God, The Fundamentalist Revolt Against the Modern Age, published in 1989 by Harper and Row. According to Bruce Lawrence, fundamentalism in the modern world is not monolithic, nor is it necessarily equatable with terms such as terrorism, militancy, and extremism. Here is Bruce Lawrence.
Well, I came to the word fundamentalism and connected it with religious activists through the experience of Iran in 1978 and 79. I am, by training, an historian of religions and also an Islamicist, and a lot of us were taken by surprise with what happened in Iran in 1978 and 79.
That really kind of crystallized things.
It crystallized things, especially in the media, when we began to hear about a group called the Iranian Shiite fundamentalists.
Well, let's see if we can unbundle some of the definitions here, Bruce Lawrence. First of all, tease out three major threads for me: the Jewish, the Christian, and the Muslim. What expressions of fundamentalism? How far back do they go? Who do we associate them with? Give it to me in broad strokes here.
Okay, in broad strokes, I would link it to the 19th century, or at the furthest range to the end of the 18th century, with what we know as the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. The Enlightenment is a shift in the nature of reason, in the nature of human understanding of the world, and it really is with the Enlightenment that you begin to have religion itself questioned as a holistic, autonomous category.
Uh-huh. You're talking about the ascendancy of science.
I'm talking about the ascendancy of science. Yes, without the ascendancy of science, I don't believe you have the possibility of enlightenment, or the beginning of what I term in this book the modern age. Mm-hmm. And so fundamentalism is a reaction to the modern age. Since the modern age has distinct phases, and since it occurs in different strokes at a different pace in various parts of the world, it's not the same everywhere. Mm-hmm. To answer your question, those who are, for instance, the Christian fundamentalists occur in the United States because the United States is a modernizing country by the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century. And the fundamentalists react to the way in which certain changes in American society seem to diminish religious values and seem to diminish especially the prevalence of God, Scripture, Christ, and the church.
The secular impulse.
The secular impulse, what is called elsewhere. The secular impulse takes hold in America in very bold terms towards the end of the 19th and into the 20th century.
Right,
it's later for Judaism, yeah, and it's still later for Islam.
All right, but that hasn't happened in the Islamic world. I mean, essentially you have, I don't know, let's pick our terms carefully here, Bruce mm-hmm. Lawrence. How do you talk about these elements of the Islamic impulse, Islamic religion, without sounding pejorative and condescending? You're really up in the air, are you not?
Well, I think you're up in the air, Wayne, unless you recognize that there have been gradients of distinction in what Marshall Hodgson calls the Great Western Transmutation.
Mm-hmm. The GWT.
The GWT. In my book, Defenders of God, I abbreviate it because Hodgson himself was a remarkable person. I would say he was a genius in his ability to recognize the broadest form of global history. But he was also, like many geniuses, very, very difficult to understand.
So you sort of telescope.
I try to telescope and translate what I believe Hodgson meant by the Great Western Transmutation. It's simply a shorthand, although it's a long phrase. It's a shorthand for talking about the peculiar characteristics of the modern age. And if you look at the great Western transmutation and the way in which nationalism, technological changes, communications revolution impacted on the Muslim world, yes, it happened at a different and a slower and a more varied pace there than it did in Europe and later in the United States.
Right.
But I don't think it's fair to say that they're backward, that they're retrograde, that they're always catching up with us. I think rather what has happened is that they have experienced the transition to the 21st century as one that must be made in religious terms, that they must have something of their cultural legacy, which for them, for most countries, is Islamic. It must somehow be retained and it must be projected in the public sphere. Mm-hmm. And the great problem with a lot of what we now hear in the press about Islam is we see only those elements that react violently
right.
to the West and to change and transition. But in fact, there is in Islamic world, as there is in Europe and the United States and also in Latin America, many, many segments that are attempting to understand and even to come to terms with the modern age, but they also are trying to do it in a religious idiom.
All right, now we've got a lot of territory to cover here, a lot of definitions and explanations to go through. Your book here on fundamentalism, Bruce Lawrence. Let's begin with the word modernity or modernism or the modern. How do you differentiate them? Why are they apparently necessarily at variance with fundamentalists?
Well, let me give you the most graphic example that comes to mind, Wayne. We can talk about airplanes, and we can talk about airplanes in 1989, 1990, because we've all experienced airplanes as just an accepted mode of conveyance, a way of traveling from one place to another in the 20th century. But it is a modern means of conveyance. Does it then change the way in which we think about the sky in relationship to the earth? For some people, perhaps, but for most people who fly, an airplane is just a way of going from one destination to another.
To a fundamentalist, by contrast?
But to a fundamentalist, the whole notion of what is an airplane also suggests one way of rethinking the world. Does it mean that because planes now project a much broader view of the globe from a higher spot than man and people have ever been able to travel before, are we then somehow calling into question God as transcendent? Most fundamentalists would argue no. They would say that an airplane means a way of getting from, let us say, from New York to Cairo faster, but it doesn't change the distance, the actual distance in terms of cultural space between New York and Cairo.
So what are you getting at here?
But I'm getting at that there is a sense in which modernists, to pick the category which I use a lot in my book, modernists would say no. There is a real difference, not only because of airplanes, but because of means of communication, of economic production, of capitalism, because of the collapsing of different groups into highly specialized modes of organization and also labor, that you do have a different world today, and this world is modernist, and it stands at more than 100 years from the pre-airplane or the pre-modern era.
All right, so
a modernist says the modern is a rupture. It's a discontinuity from the pre-modern. Fundamentalist says there should be a link.
All right, but the fundamentalist nevertheless wants to seize upon the methods and what you call the instrumentalities of the modern world. Is there no contradiction there?
Well, for a fundamentalist, no. And the big chasm, I would argue, is between modern and modernist. That is clear if you use the adjectives instead of all these slippery nouns that end in I-O-N or I-S-M, and we all get tired of those, even academics, or especially academics.
Right.
But if you think for a minute about the difference between modern and modernist, all fundamentalists, I argue in my book, are modern. They accept the fact that they live in a different age, a modern age, which does have all those technological innovations and facilities.
Yeah, and I hear the word but coming along here.
Yes, the but is those are instrumental changes.
Yeah.
Those do not change.
They don't go to the heart of
things. The heart of the world. So there still is a space between man and God, even if you're in an airplane.
So what are these fundamentalists, whether we're talking about Muslims or Christians or Jews, what are they after? I mean, let's, without being too glib here, what do fundamentalists want?
Okay, fundamentalists want, and I have not up till now talked about Jewish fundamentalists, but let me add that Jewish fundamentalists as well as Muslim and Christian fundamentalists have to be considered in thinking about those others, those who want to have a different vision for the future of our world than, let us say, those of us who I think would be most of the listeners to Soundings, are non-fundamentalists.
Is it a different view of the world, or is it a retrograde view?
No,
is it going back to something, that this halcyon blue haze of nostalgia?
I would say that fundamentalists are not nostalgic. They're not traditionalists. I differentiate them very strongly from traditionalists because they recognize the changes. They have, if anything, a vision of a sort of utopian future where they really believe that it's the public space.
Yeah, but not you say the future, not the past. I mean, isn't that where the impulse originates? Is in that wonderful back there something that we've lost?
No, it's the mandate from the past, which they
seize the future.
Which allows them to project the possibility of seizing the future.
I see.
And what they hold in common and where they differ from those of us who would not be fundamentalist, they differ because they view the future as God's space, as a divine mandate to restore some notion of sanctity in the public sphere. What they fear and what they feel has happened, and this is whether they're Christian or Jewish or Muslim, whether in the United States or Israel or Egypt, what they feel commonly is that leaders, national leaders, have turned their back on divine mandates and have allowed a separation of church and state, or in the case of Judaism and Islam, a separation of religious institutions from public policy, which for fundamentalists is a violation, a violation of the divine order, a violation of their own perception as believers.
And yet you say, Bruce Lawrence, that fundamentalism, or many fundamentalisms, we have to make that differentiation,
yes,
that they are destined to fail politically, that they will not succeed politically. How do you account for that variation, the fervor, the enthusiasm, the dedication, and yet the political failure?
We do live in a modern, some would say, a postmodern world. And when I say, as I do towards the end of my book, and I think it's important to remember that it's only in the last chapter that I do assert in a sort of predictive way that fundamentalists will fail in the public or political order. The reason they will fail is because by the very nature of fundamentalism, the outlook is holistic. It projects
unified, single,
and monolithic set of values that prevail. So by a fundamentalist canon, they must fail because they will never be able to overcome what has been a very long run of modernism. That is to say,
pluralism,
modernism, secularism, whatever other ism you want to attach to something that is non-fundamentalist, is so much a part of who we are. That is speaking about all moderns, all people who live in the end of the 20th and into the 21st century, that it will not be possible for fundamentalists to prevail even when they have temporary victories. As I argue, as I trace in my book, they have had success through the moral majority in America in the late 70s, and also as they had in Iran during the 80s, and as they will have, I would suggest, in Israel in the 90s. Even when they have that kind of success, Wayne, what I'm suggesting is it will be a temporary partial success because by the standard of fundamentalist expectation, they would have to prevail. And that kind of dominance is not possible because of their opponents, but also, and I haven't talked about this yet, but I do in my book, also because of the divisions within fundamentalists themselves about what those goals would be when they translate into public action.
Yeah, the nation state, you say, will not allow fundamentalism to succeed politically. The commercial impulse, I mean, there are lots of sort of fancy labels about the corporate presence, American and otherwise, Japanese now, and German overseas. They will not allow the fundamentalist impulse to succeed.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the Japanese, and I want to pick up on that just briefly because it is not in my book. Anybody who goes to buy Defenders of God and thinks they're going to find another way of beating the Japanese will be gravely disappointed. I don't address the Japanese either as our enemies in the pre-World War II era or as our competitors, and also we hope our collaborators in the 1980s and 1990s. But I do want to say that my book is concerned to talk about Jewish, Christian, and Muslim fundamentalists because they are the most easily identifiable groups which one can study at the present time.
So is there a fundamentalism in the Orient?
But there is a fundamentalism in the Orient, and there is a project which will become increasingly well-known, at least in academic and I think also in popular circles during the 90s, a project at the University of Chicago under Martin Marty titled The Fundamentalism Project. And it looks at fundamentalism as a global phenomenon, including a phenomenon that impinges on the Orient, including Japan. And I want to just say briefly one word about Japanese fundamentalism.
Fair enough.
The Japanese fundamentalism will not have the same ideological markings as the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim fundamentalists whom I examine in my book.
Why not?
But they will share certain functional similarities. And the functional similarities will be that, as with the groups I describe, who are Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, Japanese fundamentalists who will come out of a Shinto or rapidly nationalist orientation within Japan will take the nation state, and this is answering your question about the nation state, they will take the nation state as the order which has to reflect a Japanese pride in ruling the world once again, as according to many myths, Japan once ruled the world of the past, so that in a sense, people link China as an Oriental group that in some sense thought of the whole world as existing behind the wall. But in a sense, Japan also has a very, some Japanese have a very strong view of their islands as in some sense the focal point from which the whole of the world, beginning with Israel, this may sound surprising to some Jewish listeners, but that according to certain Japanese mythology, Jews are Latter-day descendants of Japanese.
Oh, my goodness.
So Japanese fundamentalists want to go back to their origins pre-Israelite, pre-Jewish or Christian or Muslim, and then reappropriate the world in, if you will, a Nipponese idiom of fundamentalism.
It all comes down to who's going to run the show, doesn't it, Bruce?
That's
Lawrence?
Right.
I mean, the 50-cent term here is hegemony. Who's got the power and who's going to control the chips in the game?
Yes, and I argue that you can't look at hegemony, even if you are not a Marxist, and I'm not a Marxist, but you can't look at power relationships, which really is what hegemony addresses in a sort of fancy word. Power relations or hegemony will always be negotiated by rival ideologies. Huh. And the reason I feel fundamentalism as one ideology or set of ideologies cannot succeed is because we'll always be in competition for hegemony with other ideologies, many of which will be modernist or nationalist and therefore anti-fundamentalist.
What does fundamentalism have to do with terrorism, Bruce Lawrence? Are they always together? Do we necessarily hook them up?
We do, through the media, and I want
to say we, the North American mindset.
And I want to say that the media is not the bad guy or the bad guys or the rap group for fundamentalism, although some would argue that we wouldn't now be having a program on Soundings, nor would I have written a book called Defenders of God
if there weren't TV cameras.
There weren't TV cameras and terrorists to take TV pictures of.
Yeah.
But I would say that terrorism is a minor incident of fundamentalism. I think it's very important to put it into perspective and say fundamentalism is first of all a religious ideology.
So to call them nuts and fanatics and bagmen and all of that, that's not right.
It's simply to marginalize and distance them from ourselves as if we somehow are the good guys.
Yeah.
And I want to say that, and I think most of those who have studied fundamentalists and most fundamentalists themselves would be comfortable in looking at a religious ideology, an ideology that seeks change in the modern world, that then becomes a social movement, often one of protest against the nation state and other forms of modernity, but also one that only in rare instances of outrage turns to terrorism. So the terrorism is, if you will, a kind of desperate move of only one segment in one part of the world for fundamentalism. And I want to say that it really especially links to the disparities in the global economic order, socioeconomic order, that we sometimes, again, shorthand call the third world. So that those problems of the underprivileged, of the marginalized in the capitalist world economy produce terrorism as much as some religious ideology, which we call fundamentalism.
Let's bring the conversation to American shores, Bruce Lawrence. What do you look ahead here into the 1990s? Does fundamentalism have a future in the United States? Have we seen it sort of ebb and flow here with Swaggart and Falwell and Baker? Are we, in fact, talking about fundamentalism when we put those names on the table?
Well, I think Swaggart and Baker give a bad name to evangelism in general and fundamentalism in particular, if you want to call them fundamentalists.
Yeah, Martin Marty says that amongst the Assemblies of God that there's a great sense of relief that all of this has happened.
Oh, yes, because...
Not rejoicing, but relief.
Because these people, many of the really devout folks, and there are many in Assemblies of God, resented this sort of eruption that, mm-hmm. that was associated with Swaggart, even before it had its moralizing undercurrent, which we all found out very recently, amoral undercurrent, I should say. It does a disservice to Jerry Falwell to put him in the same camp with Baker and Swaggart. It's easy to do in a media sense, but if you go and you look at the legacy of Falwell, he is, whether you like him or not, sincerely advocating a certain notion of the public order. And this comes back to something which all fundamentalists have in common, that it is not merely one's own private morality or what one does or thinks or how one prays.
The public order.
But the public order and how you have a sense of a divine legacy which is perpetuated through institutions like the public school, like the courts, like the legislature, and also like the presidency and like foreign policy.
So to these people, America really is a Christian nation.
It is a Christian nation, and that's what they're fighting for. And I don't see in what I've read about Baker and Swaggart, they have this mission. I'll call it a mission that is international in scope, which projects America as a kind of corporate entity for good to the same extent that you have it in Jerry Falwell. And I think what also sets Falwell apart is he's gone the whole route, Wayne. He's gone the whole route of moving Liberty College to Liberty University.
Yeah.
And so he has become, as I argue in my book at one point in talking about Christian fundamentalists, he's become part of mainstream Americana because you can't project into the future without doing it through education. So to answer your question about the 1990s, and let's carry it on into the 21st century, I think Falwell will be here. The legacy of Jerry Falwell through Liberty University will be here well into the 21st century after the Bakers and Swaggarts of this world have gone to their rest and their empires have been recycled as playlands, which is what they were anyway.
Theme parks.
Theme parks, yeah.
Right.
Theme parks for real carnivals instead of those that are pretending to be religious institutions.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Bruce Lawrence. Your book is Defenders of God. You're writing about fundamentalism worldwide. Let me bring you back to media, radio and television. Here we're doing a radio program. You see this stuff on the tube practically every night. I want you to elaborate for me. Media, good guys, bad guys in taking what news analysis about fundamentalism to the public?
They're both.
Uh-huh.
They're like academics. They're both good guys, bad guys.
All right.
We don't have any clear-cut categories. I say in the beginning of my book that one of the things which characterizes us as moderns is we want to dichotomize. We want to divide the whole world into two groups, you mm-hmm. know, those that we like and those that we don't. And anybody who wants to change them doesn't fit, doesn't play by our rules.
Them and us.
Them and us. Them versus us.
Yeah.
And I say that the media, like the university, like politics, the human race, is a spectrum. There are those who do it better and those who do it worse, those who succeed and those whom one would have to say fail. I would claim that many of the media, especially radio and print media, less so television media, have attempted to look at this puzzle of fundamentalism and tried to do more than just throw out headlines. And I'm thinking, for instance, of a meeting which I had at the New York Times a decade ago when the Iranian Revolution started.
Hmm.
And it was a full gathering in New York of those of us who are so-called experts on Islam, where the reporters, all of whose names are household terms, asked us and drew out of us perspectives on Iran, which have since been recycled through the news. So they listened. They didn't simply report. They didn't go after screaming one-liners. And I think also in the radio, it's possible to have, as you do on Soundings, a longer explication of what seemed to be very simple and dismissive categories. Fundamentalists, you could say, are all terrorists, fanatics, anti-moderns.
Just not the case.
Just not the case. They can be that,
mm-hmm.
but that isn't really the full resolution. And just to say that about them doesn't solve the greater puzzle, which is, what do fundamentalists mean for us?
Quick footnote here to our conversation, Bruce Lawrence. What about the teaching of religion in American schools, secondary and college? You're a professor at Duke. Are we giving the kids what they deserve? Are we, you know, fulfilling the expectations of the parents? There's so much fighting about this.
We will have fighting about religion. because religion does still relate to ultimate values. In that sense, the nation state and nationalism haven't superseded some other notion of meaning, which does attach to transcendent values and does relate to something called God. In that sense, religion has to be thought out, better done, and continued into the 21st century.
The teaching of religion.
The teaching of religion. By that, I don't mean the preaching, I mean the teaching of religion. Right. And I mean the teaching of religion in the public schools, and I mean in the universities, and also in the graduate schools of the United States. And I think we've come a long way, Wayne. We've come from being biblicists to being pure Christians to where we realize that Judaism has as much a stake as Christianity in the public sphere, and now we're letting those Muslims in a little bit. But I think to the extent that we can be pluralist and we can include fundamentalists, because I would argue that to be plural isn't to say the fundamentalists are bad, it's to study them, to appropriate them, to use the fundamentalist experience to enrich our own future experience as Americans in the 21st century.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Bruce Lawrence, an historian of religion from Duke University. Bruce Lawrence is the author of Defenders of God, The Fundamentalist Revolt Against the Modern Age, published in 1989 by Harper and Row. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Ask for program number 504. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about literature, gender, and society in Europe during the late Middle Ages and the early Renaissance. My guests will be David Wallace of the University of Texas at Austin and Stanley Hojnotsky of Michigan State University. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Happy anniversary to the Lincoln Memorial, which was dedicated 68 years ago this week. In late May 1971, the United States launched Mariner 9, the first spacecraft to orbit another planet. Late May 1936 saw the maiden voyage of the RMS Queen Mary from Southampton, England, to New York City. This week marks the birthday of America's 35th president. John F. Kennedy was born in late May 1917. Other birthdays this week include the social reformer, Amelia Jenks Bloomer, the environmental writer, Rachel Carson, the dancer, Isadora Duncan, the novelists, Arnold Bennett and John Barth, the poet, Walt Whitman, the actress, Marilyn Monroe, and Jim Thorpe, the distinguished American Indian athlete. Finally, this week marks birthdays for two notable Frenchmen, the man whose life gave us the word sadism, the Marquis de Sade, and Joseph Guillotin, the physician who, in the name of compassion, urged the use of the infamous machine which now bears his name. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Fundamentalism in the Modern World, this week on Soundings. Bruce Lawrence, an historian of religion from Duke University, discusses his recent book, Defenders of God, The Fundamentalist Revolt Against the Modern Age. According to Bruce Lawrence, fundamentalism is not monolithic, nor is it necessarily equatable with terrorism. Defenders of God, Fundamentalism in the Modern World, this week on Soundings.